Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and fall is nearly upon us. Sadly, our beach days are behind, as are those frivolous beach reads. So I thought, it's time to take a literary roundup of nonfiction titles. Fear not, these are titles that are truly riveting and in a wide range of topics. So let's begin our journey as we turn to page one of the Book Report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable, small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks, like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Start the show with a title everyone is talking about. You've seen Reza Aslan on all the talk shows. Now, let's preview Zealot, the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth. 2,000 years ago, a Jewish preacher and miracle worker walked across the Galilee, gathering followers for his kingdom of God. The revolutionary movement he launched was so threatening to the established order, he was captured, tortured, and executed. Within decades after his death, his followers would call him God. Sifting through centuries of myth-making, Aslan, who narrates, examines Jesus through the lens of the tumultuous era in which he lived, first century Palestine. Scores of Jewish prophets, preachers, and would-be messiahs wandered through the Holy Land, bearing messages from God. This was the age of zealotry, a fervent nationalism that made resistance to the Roman occupation a sacred duty incumbent on all the Jews. Balancing the Jesus of the Gospels against the historical sources, Aslan describes a man of conviction and passion, yet rife with contradiction, a man of peace who exhorted his followers to arm themselves with swords, an exorcist and faith healer who urged his disciples to keep his identity a secret, and ultimately the seditious king of the Jews whose promise of liberation from Rome went unfulfilled in his very brief lifetime.
Who killed Jonathan, son of Ananus, as he strode across the Temple Mount in the year 56 CE? No doubt there were many in Jerusalem who longed to slay the rapacious high priest, and more than a few who would have liked to wipe out the bloated temple priesthood in its entirety. For what must never be forgotten when speaking of first century Palestine is that this land, this hallowed land from which the Spirit of God flowed to the rest of the world, was occupied territory. Legions of Roman troops were stationed throughout Judea. Some 600 Roman soldiers resided atop the Temple Mount itself, within the high stone walls of the Antonia Fortress, which buttressed the northwest corner of the temple wall. The unclean centurion in his red cape and polished cuirass, who paraded through the court of Gentiles, his hand hovering over the hilt of his sword, was a not-so-subtle reminder, if any were needed, of who really ruled this sacred place. Roman dominion over Jerusalem began in 63 BCE, when Rome's master tactician Pompey Magnus entered the city with his conquering legions and laid siege to the temple. By then, Jerusalem had long since passed its economic and cultural zenith, the Canaanite settlement that King David had recast into the seat of his kingdom, the city he had passed to his wayward son Solomon, who built the first temple to God, sacked and destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE, the city that had served as the religious, economic, and political capital of the Jewish nation for 1,000 years, was, by the time Pompey strode through its gates, recognized less for its beauty and grandeur than for the religious fervor of its troublesome population. Situated on the southern plateau of the shaggy Judean mountains, between the twin peaks of Mount Scopus and the Mount of Olives, and flanked by the Kidron Valley in the east and the steep, forbidding Valley of Gehenna in the south, Jerusalem, at the time of the Roman invasion, was home to a settled population of about 100,000 people. To the Romans, it was an inconsequential speck on the imperial map, a city the wordy statesman Cicero dismissed as a hole in the corner. But to the Jews, this was the navel of the world, the axis of the universe. There was no city more unique, more holy, more venerable in all the world than Jerusalem. The purple vineyards whose vines twisted and crawled across the level plains, the well-tilled fields and viridescent orchards bursting with almond and fig and olive trees, the green beds of papyrus floating lazily along the Jordan River. The Jews not only knew and deeply loved every feature of this consecrated land, they laid claim to all of it. Everything from the farmsteads of Galilee to the low-lying hills of Samaria and the far outskirts of Idumea, where the Bible says the accursed cities of Sodom and Gomorrah once stood, was given by God to the Jews, though in fact the Jews ruled none of it, not even Jerusalem, where the true God was worshipped. The city that the Lord had clothed in splendor and glory and placed, as the prophet Ezekiel declared, in the center of all nations, the eternal kingdom on earth, was, at the dawn of the first century CE, just a minor province, and a vexing one at that, at the far corner of the mighty Roman Empire. It is not that Jerusalem was unaccustomed to invasion and occupation. Despite its exalted status in the hearts of the Jews, the truth is that Jerusalem was little more than a trifle to be passed among a succession of kings and emperors who took turns plundering and despoiling the sacred city on their way to far grander ambitions. In 586 BCE, the Babylonians, masters of Mesopotamia, rampaged through Judea, razing both Jerusalem and its temple to the ground. The Babylonians were conquered by the Persians, who allowed the Jews to return to their beloved city and rebuild their temple, not because they admired the Jews or took their cult seriously, but because they considered Jerusalem an irrelevant backwater of little interest or concern to an empire that stretched the length of Central Asia, though the prophet Isaiah would thank the Persian king Cyrus by anointing him Messiah.
That was Zealot by Reza Aslan. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, is one of those rare books that makes math and the sciences accessible to folks like me. Scientist Leonard Laudanow shows us how much randomness, chance, and probability reveal about our daily lives, and how we misunderstand the significance of everything from a casual conversation to a major financial setback. As a result, successes and failures in life are often attributed to clear and obvious causes, when in actuality, they are more profoundly influenced by chance. All our destinies reflect change as much as planning and innate abilities. Even Roger Maris, who beat Babe Ruth's single-season home run record, was in all likelihood not so much great as he was just lucky. School grades, political polls, and countless other things in daily life are less reliable than we believe. By showing us the true nature of chance and revealing the psychological illusions that cause us to misjudge the world around us, the author gives us fresh insight into what is really meaningful and how we can make decisions based on a deeper truth. Sean Pratt narrates this new way of looking at the world, and the book report says, take a chance on it.
Went parlayed that reputation into a $45 million bonus when he was hired to run the troubled finance company, Conseco. Investors apparently agreed that with Wendt at the helm, Conseco's troubles were over. The company's stock tripled within a year. But 2 years after that, Wendt abruptly resigned. Conseco went bankrupt, and the stock was trading for pennies. Had Wendt's task been impossible? Was he asleep at the wheel? Or had his coronation rested on questionable assumptions? For example, that an executive has a near-absolute ability to affect a company, or a person's single past success is a reliable indicator of future performance. On any specific occasion, one cannot be confident of the answers without examining the details of the situation at hand. I will do that in several instances in this book, but more important, I will present the tools needed to identify the footprints of chance. To swim against the current of human intuition is a difficult task. As we'll see, the human mind is built to identify for each event a definite cause, and can, therefore, have a hard time accepting the influence of unrelated or random factors. And so the first step is to realize that success or failure sometimes arises neither from great skill nor from great incompetence, but from, as the economist Armin Alkian wrote, fortuitous circumstances. Random processes are fundamental in nature and are ubiquitous in our everyday lives, yet most people do not understand them or think much about them. The title, The Drunkard's Walk, comes from a mathematical term describing random motion, such as the paths molecules follow as they fly through space, incessantly bumping and being bumped by their sister molecules. That can be a metaphor for our lives, our paths from college to career, from single life to family life, from first hole of golf to 18th. The surprise is that the tools used to understand the drunkard's walk can also be employed to help understand the events of everyday life. The goal of this book is to illustrate the role of chance in the world around us and to show how we may recognize it at work in human affairs. I hope that after this tour of the world of randomness, you, the reader, will begin to see life in a different light, with a deeper understanding of the everyday world. Chapter 1. Peering Through the Eyepiece of Randomness. I remember as a teenager watching the yellow flame of the Sabbath candles dancing randomly above the white paraffin cylinders that fueled them. I was too young to think candlelight romantic, but I still found it magical, because of the flickering images created by the fire. They shifted and morphed, grew and waned, all without apparent cause or plan. Surely, I believed, there must be rhyme and reason underlying the flame, some pattern that scientists could predict and explain with their mathematical equations. "Life isn't like that," my father told me. "Sometimes things happen that cannot be foreseen." He told me of the time when, in Buchenwald, the Nazi concentration camp in which he was imprisoned and starving, he stole a loaf of bread from the bakery. The baker had the Gestapo gather everyone who might have committed the crime and line the suspects up. "Who stole the bread?" the baker asked. When no one answered, he told the guards to shoot the suspects one by one until either they were all dead or someone confessed. My father stepped forward to spare the others. He did not try to paint himself in a heroic light, but told me that he did it because he expected to be shot either way. Instead of having him killed, though, the baker gave my father a plum job as his assistant. "A chance event," my father said. "It had nothing to do with you, but had it happened differently, you would never have been born." It struck me then that I have Hitler to thank for my existence, for the Germans had killed my father's wife and two young children, erasing his prior life. And so were it not for the war, my father would never have emigrated to New York, never have met my mother, also a refugee, and never have produced me and my two brothers.
We've just heard The Drunkard's Walk by Leonard Laudinow. In search of adventure, 29-year-old Connor Grennan traded his day job for a year-long trip around the globe, a journey that began with a 3-month stint volunteering at the Little Prince's Children's Home, an orphanage in war-torn Nepal. The result changed his life and brought us Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal. Connor had been reluctant to volunteer, unsure he had enough passion to get involved in the middle of a civil war. But soon he was overcome by the herd of rambunctious, resilient kids who would challenge and reward him in ways he'd never imagined. When Connor learned the unthinkable truth about their situation, he was stunned. The children were not orphans. Child traffickers had promised families in remote villages to protect their children from civil war for a huge fee by taking them to safety. They would then abandon the children far from home in the chaos of Kathmandu. For Connor, who narrates the book, what began as a footloose adventure became a commitment to reunite the children with their families. He would risk his life in the legendary mountains of Nepal, facing the dangers of a civil war and a debilitating injury. Waiting for Connor in Kathmandu, and hopeful he would make it out before being trapped by snow, was the woman who would become his wife and share his life's work.
The brochures for volunteering in Nepal had said civil war. Being an American, I assumed the writers of the brochure were doing what I did all the time, exaggerating. No organization was going to send volunteers into a conflict zone. Still, I made sure to point out that particular line to everybody I knew. An orphanage in Nepal for 2 months, I would tell women I'd met in bars. Sure, there's a civil war going on, and yes, it might be dangerous. But I can't think about that, I would shout over the noise of the bar, trying to appear misty-eyed. I have to think about the children. Now, as I left the Kathmandu airport in a beat-up old taxi, I couldn't help but notice that the gate was guarded by men in camouflage. They peered in at me as we slowed to pass them, the barrels of their machine guns a few inches from my window. Outside the gate, sandbagged bunkers lined the airport perimeter, where young men in fatigues aimed heavy weapons at passing cars. Government buildings were wrapped in barbed wire. Gas stations were protected by armored vehicles. Soldiers inspected each car in the mile-long line for gas. In the back seat of the taxi, I dug the brochure out of my backpack and quickly flipped to the Nepal section. Civil war, it said again, in the same breezy font used to describe the country's fauna. Couldn't they have added exclamation points? Maybe put it in huge red letters and followed it with, no lie, or not your kind of thing. How was I supposed to know they were telling the truth? As we bounced along the potholed road, I turned longingly to the other opportunities in the volunteering brochure, ones that offered a 6-week tour of duty in some Australian coastal paradise, petting baby koalas that were stricken with loneliness. I never could have gotten away with that. I needed this volunteering stint to sound as challenging as possible to my friends and family back home. In that, at least, I had succeeded. I would be taking care of orphans in one of the poorest countries in the world. It was the perfect way to begin my year-long adventure. Nepal was merely the first stop in a 1-year solo round-the-world trip. I had spent the previous 8 years working for the East-West Institute, an international public policy think tank, out of their Prague office, and later, the Brussels office. It had been my first and only job out of college, and I loved it. 8 years later, though, I was bored and desperately needed some kind of radical change. Luckily, for the first time in my life, I had some real savings. I was raised in a thrifty Irish-American household. Living in inexpensive Prague for 6 years allowed me to save much of my income. Moreover, I was single, had no mortgage or plans to get married or have kids any time in the next several decades. So I decided, rather quickly and rashly, to spend my entire net worth on a trip around the world. I couldn't get much more radical than that. I wasted no time in telling my friends about my plan, confident that it would impress them. I soon discovered that such a trip, while sounding extremely cool, also sounded unrepentantly self-indulgent. Even my most party-hardened friends, on whom I had counted to support this adventure, hinted that this might not be the wisest life decision. They used words I hadn't heard from them before, like retirement savings and your children's college fund. I had to look that last one up. It turned out to be a real thing. More disapproval was bound to follow. But there was something about volunteering in a third world orphanage at the outset of my trip that would squash any potential criticism. Who would dare begrudge me my year of fun after doing something like that? If I caught any flack for my decision to travel, I would have a devastating comeback ready, like, "Well, frankly, Mom, I didn't peg you for somebody who hates orphans." And I would make sure to say the word orphans really loudly so everybody within earshot knew how selfless I was. I looked out the dirty taxi window. Through the swarm of motorcycles and overcrowded buses, I saw a small park that had been converted into a base for military vehicles.
We've just heard Little Princes by Connor Grennan. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans, and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics is Daniel James Brown's tale of the University of Washington's 1936 eight-oar crew and their epic quest for Olympic gold. The sons of loggers, shipyard workers, and farmers, the boys defeated elite rivals, first from Eastern and British universities, and finally the German crew rowing for Hitler. The heart of the story lies with one rower, Joe Rance, a teenager without family or prospects, who rows not for glory, but to regain his shattered self-regard and to find a place he can call home. The crew is assembled by an enigmatic coach and mentored by a visionary, eccentric British boat builder. The team reminds the country of what can be done when everyone quite literally pulls together, a perfect melding of commitment, determination, and optimism. Drawing on the boys' own diaries and journals, their photos and memories of a once-in-a-lifetime shared dream, The Boys in the Boat, narrated by Edward Herman, is an irresistible story about beating the odds.
It is hard to make that boat go as fast as you want to. The enemy, of course, is resistance of the water, as you have to displace the amount of water equal to the weight of men and equipment. But that very water is what supports you, and that very enemy is your friend. So is life. The very problems you must overcome also support you and make you stronger in overcoming them. George Yeoman Pocock. On a stormy night in November 1924, Tula Rance went into labor in her cabin at the Gold and Ruby Mine. As she lay moaning in her bed, Harry set off for Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, 18 miles away on twisting mountain roads, to fetch a doctor. He promptly came to a washed-out bridge on the only road out of town. With help from some of the miners, he rebuilt the bridge, made it to Bonner's Ferry, and returned just in time for the doctor to deliver his first daughter, Rose. But it had taken all night. That was the last straw for Tula. She was done with the cabin, done with the mine, done with Idaho. A few weeks later, they packed up the Franklin, picked up Joe from the schoolhouse, drove to Seattle, and moved into the basement of Tula's parents' home on Alki Point. For the first time in a year, they all lived under one roof. It didn't go well. Tula, with yet another infant to tend to, was no happier in their cramped quarters in the basement than she had been in the cabin. Once again, Joe in particular seemed to be always underfoot. So when Harry got a job as a mechanic with the Hamahama Logging Company out on the Hood Canal, a half-day's journey west of Seattle by car and ferry, Joe had to leave too. Harry took his son, still 10, to live with a family named Schwartz near the logging camp. By 1925, Harry had saved up a bit of money from the Hamahama job and used it to put a down payment on an auto repair and tire shop in Squim, on the north side of the Olympic Peninsula. The shop was located right downtown on Washington Street, the main thoroughfare through town, squarely on the route of anyone traveling from Seattle to Port Angeles or farther out onto the peninsula. It seemed a good location, and it got Harry back to doing what he loved most, tinkering with cars. The whole family moved into a small apartment over the shop. Joe enrolled in the Squim School. He spent his weekends helping his father work on cars, tinkering with carburetors and learning to vulcanize rubber, and partly out of eagerness to stay out of Tula's way upstairs. When the mayor of Squim smashed up Harry's Franklin while ogling a passing girl, breaking its wooden frame, he bought Harry a newer model, and Harry gave Joe the older Franklin so he could learn by repairing it. A second daughter, Polly, was born that year, and as his business took root, Harry bought a stump farm, 160 acres of recently logged land southwest of town. There he began to build, with his own hands, a large farmhouse. Squim sat on a wide expanse of prairie between the snow-capped Olympic Mountains to the south and the broad blue strait of Juan de Fuca to the north. Vancouver Island was just visible on the horizon. Nestled in the lee of the mountains, sheltered from the storms that rotated in off the Pacific from the southwest, the area was far less rainy than most of western Washington, and the skies were blue more often than gray. The weather was so dry, in fact, that early settlers had found cacti growing in places. It was the kind of town where people got together on weekends to build a new church to hold Sunday afternoon ice cream socials, or to kick up their heels at Saturday night square dances. In Squim, your butcher might also be the volunteer firefighter who saved your house or barn, as well as the neighbor who helped you rebuild it. It was a place where native women from the nearby Jamestown Sklallam tribe might share recipes with a Protestant minister's wife over a cup of coffee at Drake's Cafe, where old men sat in front of the post office on Saturday afternoon, spitting brown arcs of tobacco juice into strategically arranged spittoons, where boys could sell melons purloined from local vegetable patches to Honolulu Pete at his fruit truck parked on Seal Street, where children could wander into Layman's Meat Market and be given a free hot dog in a bun just because they looked hungry, or where they might stop by Brayton Drugstore and be handed a piece of candy just because they said, "Please."
That was The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown. Chef John Moeller is a member of an elite corps of chefs who've served in the White House. Chef John cooked for three first families, President George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. John grew up in the heart of Amish country in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. What started in high school as a passion for cooking led to his decision to pursue a culinary career. After working in several New England restaurants, John took a trip to France in 1984 that would become a 2.5-year journey of discovery, working his way across the region and studying fundamentals of French cuisine under some of the finest French chefs. Next, Chef John traveled to St. Croix, where he experimented with Caribbean flavors to complement his classical French cooking. When he moved to Washington, D.C. in 1987, a chance meeting at the Mayflower Hotel led to a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There he met Chef Pierre Chambron of Maison Blanche. Chambron would later become a White House executive chef for the Bush administration, and he hired Chef John as his sous chef. Chef John served in the White House from September 92 until 2005, one of the longest tenured chefs across three administrations. Chef John now runs State of Affairs Catering in his hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Today we'll speak with him about his new book, Dining at the White House, From the President's Table to Yours. Welcome, Chef John. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report today.
Oh, thank you, Elaine. Thanks for inviting me.
What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I mean, I left the White House at the end of 2005, and then a couple of years had passed, and I kept mulling over. I mean, I have boxes and boxes of memorabilia and documents and photos and just and obviously a wealth of information inside my mind here on everything. And then Well, I had talked to a couple of people about the idea of writing a book, and then after I moved back to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, I came across Life Reloaded Publishing. They contacted me to do a reception for them for a book launch. And after we got done talking about the menu and what have you, I said, hey, you know, I got a story. You want to hear it? And so we started talking about it, and we spent like a month or two just kind of going over some ideals and what have you. And of course, I brought a few big old boxes of stuff over of things, and then we started scanning items. Ended up scanning almost 2,000 items, literally. And then we started taking shape on what we're going to do with the story and everything. And then that was like 2.5 years ago. So it's been over 2.5 years in the making.
Oh, all right. You know, I've often wondered, and I'm sure most people wonder, how does the White House kitchen know about guest preferences, food allergies, dietary restrictions of the many heads of state that you serve?
Very good question. We are obviously very concerned about everybody that comes to the White House and dines, but more importantly, we're very, very concerned about our President First Lady and the visiting heads of states or dignitaries that are coming in. So obviously for them, we will have contact through our State Department. We'll be in contact with their embassies, and they will forward us what we refer to as dietary restrictions. And I usually wait for that before I start writing a menu, because you'll find out, you know, between religious concerns and just dietary issues that may occur through their diet or just likes and dislikes in general. And then I'll take that dietary concerns there, and then I'll start building a menu around that.
All right. One of your celebrity White House guests was Julia Child. What was it like to prepare a meal for her?
As I mentioned the book there, I mean, in a way, I'm so glad that I did not know about it before she actually arrived. We found out about it actually as she arrived at the White House for dining that day. And what we had done at that point in time was our chef would give out different jobs to different people here. And that one was given to me about a month or so before that event had occurred. So when you have the event, you are the chef of the day. I will take the menus, I'll start writing them, I get them all okay through the social office, and then they will get back to me about any concerns. We finalize it, they send it to the calligrapher, they will write up the official menus and what have you, and then I book it. You know, this is I buy all the food, I organize all the prep, and then I execute it. So when it's just at the point of execution, that's when we heard that Julia Child was there for a luncheon. And so as much as I was happy about it, I didn't have much time to really think about making any changes. I mean, this was pretty much what it was going to be here. And after the luncheon was served, the chef came up to me and said that it looks like everybody's real happy up there. And a couple of minutes later, lo and behold, there's Julia Child. She comes around the corner and she walks into the kitchen. And she came in and congratulated us all for a job well done and went on to talk about how good the food was.
When you're having a state dinner, for example, how large is the culinary staff?
Well, the staff, the core staff, is 3 in the kitchen, 2 in the pastry. So we're the full-timers. That's 5 on staff. When we get to a state dinner, generally a state dinner is 130 people. 130 guests, should I say. In the state dining room, we can put 13 tables of 10 in there, and generally speaking, that's what it may be. Once in a while, we may expand over to the east room, where we can maybe go up to 200 and add another 40 for a larger event. We can even expand it up to 240 if we didn't have like a state dinner type of setup. We've even done some state dinners outside on the south lawn in pavilions, and we had a couple hundred for those. But let's go back to 130. Basically, for 130, we may bring in about 6, 7, 8 people to help us on top of the crew that we already have there.
That doesn't seem that large. What happens when the first family is eating by themselves? How many people are in the kitchen?
You are usually solo. When I'm on, which is referred to as family, you take care of the menus, you write the menus, get them okayed upstairs, and then you buy the food, and then you execute them. And so if it's just the two of them, there's usually one chef on duty, one or two butlers, depending on how many guests are there, and a kitchen steward. And that's the normal day if there's no receptions or anything going on in the house.
And what about when the family goes to Camp David? Do you travel with them?
Not usually. First of all, the Navy takes care of all the hospitality up in the Camp David area, and they also maintain all the cabins, and the Marines protect it. But what you will see, and we will go up there, is when you see a dignitary, head of state, or some big powwow going up at Camp David, usually we're up there for that one. We'll treat that as like a catering gig, and then take the show on road and do all the preparation down in Washington, and then take it up to Camp David. It's about an hour and a half drive from downtown Washington up to Camp David, and then execute it that way.
Mm-hmm. And what about Air Force One?
Military. That's the Air Force has their own galley team. I got a chance to meet those guys once. They came down to the White House for a tour, and they always invited me to come over and check out the Air Force One. That's one regret I do have is I never had a chance to get over to Andrews. But also, the president has a personal valet who is Navy-driven, and he will travel with the president everywhere in the world. And he will be, when he's setting up for a long tour somewhere, I see him in his room there with a list of every place he's got to go to, what he needs from a black tie to a white tie to a golf outing. All these things have to be obviously orchestrated before they leave the house.
You credit Hillary Clinton with transforming White House cuisine to reflect a more modern American taste. Talk about that.
We started using, and I always was a very big believer, and I still am, is using as much local ingredients as you can, fresh as possible. Organic, if you can. If not, you look for the next best thing. We were getting product in from all over the United States to try different things. And it was a great opportunity for me to basically play with my food.
Right.
I was just constantly trying all these different things here on a regular basis here, and that was pretty intriguing.
How did you choose the recipes that you included in the book?
Well, after looking over all these menu cards, and you saw them inside the book, that we created a new one for every event. And if you look at all of them, I have about over 400 of them. I was pretty vigilant about saving them after each event. And I had to go through and wanted to find ones that were ones that I created, number one, and also wanted something that would reflect a balance of different items that I can showcase in the book.
All right. Well, readers, I want to tell you that the book has beautiful photography, and it's a really wonderfully interesting read with great recipes. Chef John, thanks so much for joining us today. Powerful players. Ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Attention foodies, before your beloved Food Network, there was Chef Tell, Friedemann Paul Earhart, America's first TV showman chef. Ronald Joseph Kuhl explores the life of the man big on personality and flavor in Chef Tell, the biography of America's pioneer TV showman chef. Most of Chef Tell's 40 million baby boomer viewers, a number comparable to Julia Child's, never knew his fascinating hardscrabble life story. This wonderfully readable biography puts us behind the line inside his kitchen and inside his, at times, turbulent personal life. John McLean performs this absorbing account of an extraordinary man.
Chef Tell's recipe for making a starbound chef/restaurateur went like this. First, rise with the morning twilight. Visit the fish, meat, and produce markets daily to ensure your menu and daily ingredients are as fresh as possible. Chastise your vendors, if needed, for quality slippage in your last order, yet make them feel like they are part of your success. Second, walk several miles daily within the same four walls. Regularly add water, salt, chicken stock, and splashes of wine to foods and to yourself. Even though you know it will take a toll on your body, taste everything you cook. Third, ensure that your kitchen waitstaffs arrive on time, prepared, and sober. Mix in your waitpersons, bartenders, hostesses, and accountants. Keep them honest with your cash register, every day. Fourth, bring the first, second, and third steps to a boil by simmering under low heat in the first few hours of the day. Gradually turn up the heat. Fifth, repeat the routine 312 days a year, 6 days a week, year after year, despite how you feel, as long as you make your patrons happy. For superstar ranking, add one more requisite: culinary genius, the capacity to take consumable ingredients and envision them into remarkable repurposed foods, flavors, and presentations, the capacity to be avant-garde, innovative, iconoclastic, and visionary, and in Chef Tell's case, funny. Chef Tell followed the basic rules of cooking, but he blazed new trails his way.
That was Chef Tell by Ronald Joseph Kuhl. Jane Ridley's Birdie, A Life of Edward VII, is a riveting study of a flawed, fascinating Prince of Wales. Much of the story is seen through the eyes of the women in his life: society hostess Daisy Brooke, Lily Langtree, and Alice Keppel. Edward was 59 when he ascended the throne in 1901. He was king for the final 10 years of his life. Known as Bertie, the eldest son of Victoria and Albert, he was bullied by his parents and never given any proper responsibilities. He spent his time eating, bedding, and womanizing. When Bertie finally became king, he did a good job, especially in foreign policy. This study gives Bertie his due while painting a vivid portrait of the age in all its excesses and eccentricity. Carol Boyd narrates.
Albert, who, according to his private secretary, was very happy, but too anxious and nervous to bear his happiness with much calmness, showed the baby to the ministers waiting next door. The healthy boy was the first Prince of Wales to be born since 1762. But for his mother, this was not a cause for rejoicing. The fate of Princess Charlotte, Victoria's first cousin, can never have been far from the mind of Dr. Locock. Charlotte died in November 1817 after an agonizing 50-hour labor, having given birth to a stillborn son. Her accoucheur, the fancy French title for what was little more than an unqualified male midwife, shot himself 3 months later. If Charlotte had not succumbed to postpartum hemorrhage, Queen Victoria would not have been born. Her death detonated a crisis of succession for the Hanoverian dynasty. Not only was she the sole legitimate child of the Prince Regent, later George IV, but, incredibly, she was the only legitimate grandchild of George III, in spite of the fact that he had fathered a brood of 6 princesses and 7 princes. Not that the Hanoverians were an infertile lot. 3 of the daughters of George III remained spinsters, and the 3 princesses who married were childless. But the 7 sons managed to sire an estimated 20 children between them. All except Charlotte were illegitimate. The sons of George III had failed in their fundamental dynastic purpose to ensure the succession. When Charlotte died, Lord Byron threw open the windows of his Venice apartment and emitted a piercing scream over the Grand Canal. She was the only member of the royal family whom the people loved, and with her death, the credibility of the monarchy slumped. The Prince Regent, who reigned in place of his old mad father, George III, was lecherous, gluttonous, and grossly self-indulgent. How he had managed to father Princess Charlotte was a mystery. On his wedding night, he was so drunk that he slept in the fireplace. He banished his wife and treated her with ostentatious cruelty, which made him deeply disliked. He and his brothers were the so-called wicked uncles of Queen Victoria, and even by the rake-hell standards of the day, they were dissolute. Charlotte's death forced these middle-aged roués, with their dyed whiskers, their wigs, and their paunches, to enter into an undignified race to beget an heir. One by one, they dumped their mistresses and hastened to the altar. Their choice of brides was limited by the Royal Marriages Act, introduced by George III in 1772, which made it illegal for the king's children to marry without his consent. The royal family disapproved of princes marrying into the English aristocracy, as this involved the monarchy in party politics. Under the Act of Settlement of 1701, Roman Catholics were excluded from the succession, so the royal marriage market was effectively confined to the small Protestant German courts, which acted as stud farms for the Hanoverian monarchy. Prince Edward, Duke of Kent, was the fourth son of George III. Neither dissolute nor vicious, he was large and talkative with a certain sly cunning. He smelled of garlic and tobacco, and he was always in debt. In the army he was a stickler for uniforms and a harsh disciplinarian, heartily disliked by the rank and file.
We've just heard Bertie by Jane Ridley. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. At age 18, Amanda Lindout moved from her hardscrabble Alberta hometown to the big city, Calgary. There she worked as a cocktail waitress, saving her tips so she could travel the globe. As a child, she'd escaped a violent household by paging through National Geographic and imagining herself in its exotic locales. Now she would see those places for real. She backpacked through Latin America, Laos, Bangladesh, and India. Emboldened by each experience, she went on to travel solo across Sudan, Syria, and Pakistan. In war-ridden Afghanistan and Iraq, she carved out a fledgling career as a TV reporter. In August 2008, she traveled to Mogadishu, Somalia, to report on the fighting there. On her fourth day in country, she and her photojournalist were abducted. A House in the Sky, written with Sarah Corbett, is the astoundingly intimate and harrowing account of Amanda's 15 months as a captive. She was kept in chains, nearly starved, and subjected to unthinkable abuse. She survived by imagining herself in a house in the sky, looking down at the woman shackled below. Amanda's decision upon her release to counter the violence she endured by founding an organization to help the Somali people rebuild their country is a testament to the human spirit. The author narrates,
I kept them stacked on a nightstand next to my bunk bed. I reached for them when I needed them, when the apartment where we lived got too noisy. The world arrived in waves and flashes, as a silvery tide sweeping over a promenade in Havana, or the glinting snowfields of Annapurna. The world was a tribe of pygmy archers in the Congo and the green geometry of Kyoto's tea gardens. It was a yellow-sailed catamaran in a choppy Arctic sea. I was 9 years old and living in a town called Sylvan Lake. The lake was 6 miles long, a Pleistocene gash in the vast brown prairie of Alberta, Canada, well north of the Calgary skyline, while south of the oil rigs scattered around Edmonton, 100 or so miles east of the Rocky Mountains, a solidly in-between place. In July and August, tourists came to float on the lake's calm surface and toss fishing lines from the docks of their cottages. There was a downtown marina next to a red-topped lighthouse and a small amusement park where vacationers bought tickets to ride down a giant, spiraling waterslide, or run through a play maze made of brightly painted plywood. All summer long, the sounds of laughing kids and the buzz of motorboats floated through town. We were new to Sylvan Lake. My mother, having split from my father a few years earlier, had moved my two brothers and me there from Red Deer, the small city where we'd always lived, 15 minutes down the road. Russell, her boyfriend, had come with us, and so had his younger brother, Stevie. His uncles and cousins and other brothers and second cousins often dropped in on us for payday parties and ended up in our apartment for days, camped out in our living room. I remember their faces hoisted in sleep, their slim brown arms hanging from the sides of our chairs. My mother referred to Russell and his family as native, but around town people called them Indians. Our building was a white stucco fourplex with a pitched roof and dark wood balconies. The recessed windows of our basement apartment were small and narrow and let in next to no daylight. A green municipal dumpster sat in the gravel parking lot outside. My mother, a fan of all things bright and tropical, hung a teal shower curtain in our new bathroom and draped a brightly patterned spread over her bed. Out in the living room, she parked her exercise bike next to our old brown sofa. People always looked at my mother. She was tall and lean, with dramatic cheekbones and dark permed hair she kept fluffed up around the ears. She had limpid brown eyes that suggested a kind of vulnerability, the possibility that she might be easily talked in and out of things. 5 days a week, she put on a white dress with red piping and drove back to Red Deer to work a cash register at Food City. She returned with whole flats of generic brand juice boxes, bought with her discount, which we stashed in the freezer and ate after school using spoons. Sometimes she came home with a plastic tray of bakery leftovers, danishes and eclairs gone sticky after a day under glass. Other times she brought video rentals that we never returned. Russell worked only sometimes, signing on for a few weeks or occasionally a few months of contract work as a tree trimmer with an arbor company called High Tree, cutting limbs away from power lines along narrow roads. He was thin as a whippet and wore his dark hair long around his shoulders and feathered on the sides. When he wasn't working, he dressed in thin silk shirts in colors like purple and turquoise. Etched on his left forearm was a homemade tattoo, a blue-lined bird with broad wings, an eagle or a phoenix, maybe. Its outline had begun to fade, the bird's details washed into a pale blur on his skin, like something belonging on the body of a much older man. He was 21 to my mother's 32. We'd known Russell for years before he became my mom's boyfriend. Since the time he was 13, our families knit together by some combination of bad luck and Christian largesse. He had been raised on the Sunchild First Nation Reserve. His father had disappeared early. His mother died in a car accident. My mother's parents, who lived about an hour's drive from the reserve, ran a Pentecostal summer camp for First Nations kids and ended up taking in Russell and his four younger brothers as foster children. My mother and her siblings were long gone at that point, and the native kids offered my grandparents a kind of second go-round at parenting.
We've just heard The House in the Sky by Amanda Lindhout and Sarah Corbett.
Readers, while I was in Hyannis to attend this year's Cape Cod Writers' Festival, I was lucky enough to see Buddy Guy perform at a local music venue. Guy, according to Eric Clapton, John Mayer, and the late Stevie Ray Vaughan, is the greatest blues guitarist of all time. Many pros believe him to be the living embodiment of the Chicago blues. Guy tells his epic story in When I Left Home, written with David Ritz. Guy came to Chicago from rural Louisiana in the 50s, the very moment when urban blues were electrifying our culture. He was a regular session player at Chess Records. Willie Dixon was his mentor. He was a sideman in the bands of Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. He and Junior Wells formed a band of their own. In the 60s, he became a recording star in his own right. When I Left Home tells Guy's story in his own words, those of a storyteller who remembers everything. Keith Richards said of Guy, "Buddy has never failed to amaze me, first as an artist and secondly as a beautiful guy. Long may he give us his gift." The book is performed by Miren Willis.
You might be looking through a book of pictures, or walking through a museum where they got photographs of people picking cotton back in the 1940s. Your eye might be drawn to a photo of a family out in the fields. There's a father with his big old sack filled with cotton. There's a woman next to him, maybe his wife, maybe his sister. And next to them is a boy, maybe 9 years old. He got him a flour sack. That's all he can manage. After all, it's his first day picking. That little boy could be me. I started picking at about that age. I stood next to my daddy, who showed me how to do the job right. Depending where you're coming from, you could feel sorry for that little boy, thinking he's being misused. You could feel he's too young to work like that. You could decide that the world he was born into, the world of sharecropping, was cruel and unfair. And you wouldn't be entirely wrong. Except that if that boy was me, and you were able to get inside my little head, you'd find that I was happy being out there with my daddy, doing the work that the big people did. I wanted to be grown and help my family any way I could. Didn't know anything else except the land and the sky and the seasons and the fruits and the fish and the horses and the cows and the pigs and the pecans and the birds and the moss and the white cotton that we prayed came up plentiful enough to give us enough money to make it through winter. I saw the world through the eyes of my mama and daddy. Their eyes were looking at the earth. The earth had to yield. If it did, we ate. If it didn't, we scrambled. Because we didn't have no electricity, not for the first 12 years of my life, we were cut off from what was happening outside our little spot in Louisiana called Letsworth. I didn't know it at the time, but we were living and farming like people lived and farmed 100 years before. When I got my little flour sack and went out in the field, I was doing something my people have been doing ever since we were herded up like cattle in Africa, sent out on slave boats, and forced to work the land of the southern states of America. That fact, though, was something that came into my mind when I was an adult, playing my music in Senegal. Someone brought me to the point of no return, one of the places where slaves were sent off to make their terrible Atlantic crossing. Maybe that's where the blues began. But to me, 9-year-old George Buddy Guy, son of Sam and Isabel Guy, born July 30, 1936, Black history was not part of the elementary schooling I got at the True Vine Baptist Church. That's where I was taught to use utensils and read little books about white children called Dick and Jane. Black people weren't in those books. Blacks weren't part of history. All we knew was the present time. We knew today, and today meant shuck the corn and feed the pig and go to school in the evenings after our chores were done. I had fears, snakes and lightning and ghosts who were said to haunt the graveyards. But I had something bigger than those fears, a feeling of family. Back then, family feeling was stronger than it is today. If you had a righteous mom and dad like I did, they could make you feel that no matter what, everything was all right. If you had two older sisters like mine, Anna May and Fanny, and two younger brothers, Philip and Sam, who always had your back, you felt protected. We lived in a wooden shack built up on pillars. We didn't have no indoor plumbing. When it was blistering hot and we wanted to escape the heat, we'd go under the cabin where the dirt was cool. The inside was just a couple rooms and a wood-burning stove. No running water. We pumped the water into a number 3 tub for our weekly baths. We also used those tubs to soak the pecans we picked so that when we sold them by the pound, they weighed a little more.
That was When I Left Home by Buddy Guy with David Ritz. Thanks for joining me today in this exploration of nonfiction titles. Fascinating stuff, right?
For more titles on most every topic, check my website, bookreportradio.com. See you back here next week on The Book Report.